The ninth. My apologies to all of you. I had a speaking engagement that went over, and so I apologize for inconveniencing you. We will get to all the public testimony that's here on both bills today. If we don't get all the way through moving the bills out, which I think we might today, we've got an efficient committee made up of Representative Anderson, Dahlstrom, Coghill, and myself, McGuire. Then we will continue next week, but there's a good chance we can get through this today. So, without further ado, we have House Bill 81 and the bill's sponsor's representative, Mr. Bittner. John Bittner is here to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Bittner. I'm staff to Representative Anderson. I'm here to talk about House Bill 81. House Bill 81 changes the way the state of Alaska deals with unregistered contractors. Currently, Alaska exempts individuals from getting a contractor's license if they're working on a job that costs less than $5,000 in materials and labor. This has resulted in about 1,600 unregistered handymen operating in Alaska today, which represents about 23% of the contractor market. This is by far the largest category. This exemption category is the largest category of any contractor category. Under the current statutes, the Department of Labor and Commerce and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development handle violations of work performed by unlicensed contractors by issuing citations, which are left to the Department of Law to prosecute. Enforcement of these citations is extremely difficult. HB 81 allows the Department of Labor and Commerce and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development to issue civil penalty fines for violations instead of citations. The fines created in HB 81 are $1,000 for the first violation and $1,500 for subsequent violations. The fine is appealed to an administrative hearing officer if needed. The benefit of this system is that it allows the Department of Labor and Commerce and the DCCED to quickly and effectively prosecute violators in an effective way that is currently unavailable. The violations in this section won't be applied to communities of less than 1,000 people not connected by road or rail to Anchorage or Fairbanks. Our best guess and the best information we have is that that means 232 communities will be exempt. With that, I'll open myself up to questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bittner, pertaining to that last issue that you had talked about, the 232 committees that would be exempt from this, do we have anyone from Department of Law, or had you had conversations with people in the Department of Law who have commented on equal protection issues?
It is my understanding, through the Chair, Representative Dahlstrom, it is my understanding that the Department of Law has seen the language in this bill, mm-hmm. and it passed through them before it got to us, and they said that it was enforceable.
Do we, Madam Chair, is there anyone from the Department of Law here?
Through the Chair, I don't know. I do not believe so.
We have somebody from the Department of Labor that might be able to answer that. And Representative Dahlstrom, you're talking about the fact that there's a, on page 2, subsection E?
Correct.
Yeah. And I do, well, Mr. Bittner, maybe you could even just tell us what the rationale was behind that. I assume it was inserted for a reason.
It was. Actually, there are several contractors online who would probably be better able to give you examples of why this is necessary than myself.
Okay.
I mean, that's all right.
Fantastic. Okay, any further questions for Mr. Bittner? Okay, thank you. And Representative Cott joined us right after the start of the meeting. Okay, I will go to Mr. Al Nagel with the Department of Labor Standards. He's online to answer questions, and I don't know, Mr. Nagel, if you heard Representative Dahlstrom's question regarding Section E, subsection E on page 2.
Madam Chair, Program Manager for Animal Protection for the Labor and Workforce Development here in Anchorage. I don't honestly know the rationale between that for that paragraph. I'm sorry.
Okay. Did you have testimony that you wanted to offer on the bill today?
I don't be prepared to strictly answer questions to the committee.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Nagel? Okay. Hearing none. We will go to Dave Dillard in Fairbanks with the Alaska State Home Building Association. Mr. Dillard, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you all for hearing us today on this Hospital 81. As a home building association, I am president this year. I'm over here in the Bank area.
Actually, Mr. Dillard, are you talking on a speakerphone?
Yes, ma'am.
For some reason this year, and I'm going to put this out here to teleconferencing, I don't understand why, but throughout this year only, we have not been able to get a clear reception from folks on the speakerphone. And I hope we can change that, because I know that's more convenient for people. But in the meantime, if you could pick up the handpiece, we could hear you a lot better in the committee, and my apologies for that.
Marie to the LIO. I'm going to have to dial back in from a different phone.
Okay.
So just give us a minute.
No problem. Okay. We'll set that aside and just why don't we go ahead and go to folks here in the audience as we await them coming back online. Jeff DeSmet. DeSmet? My apologies. DeSmet? Just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Jeffrey DeSmet, and I represent the Southeast Alaska Building Industry Association as their president. It's a pleasure to testify before you today on behalf of House Bill 81. I believe in your packet you received an email from me, and I guess I'll be brief. We're in support of House Bill 81, and if you would allow me, I'd just read from that email.
Sure.
As a member of the construction industry in Alaska for 30 years, I urge you, Madam Chairman, and your committee to support House Bill 81. As you're aware, there are problems with unlicensed contractors building homes in the state of Alaska. These people continue to ignore the current statutes and thunder noses at licensed professional builders and remodelers. Your support of House Bill 81 would go a long way to protect Alaskan consumers from illegal contractors and help Department of Labor and Occupational Licensing Enforcement officers pressure these individuals into current statute compliance. As a member of the Board of Directors for the Alaska State Home Builders as well, representing over 250 licensed general contractors, we strongly would urge your consideration of House Bill 81.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you answer, because I recall the discussions a little bit, we didn't get too involved with it, but with subsection E on page 2 and what, of course, I'm facilitating the bill as the sponsor, but I didn't create the language, it was recommended.
Madam Chair, through the chair to Representative Anderson, I would defer that to Mr. Bitney.
Okay.
Okay, absolutely. Why don't you pull up a chair? Just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Chair, my name is John Bitney. I am under contract and registered as a lobbyist with the Alaska State Home Builders Association. The bill that's in front of you is the product of a work group within our industry and also with the other association known as Association of Builders and Contractors. And in putting it together, we had a discussion about issues in rural Alaska in terms of being able to obtain a licensed contractor, that there are this bill just gets into, it doesn't change anything in terms of current standards for licensing, but at least what we're trying to do with this language was somehow put out some sort of recognition that there is a problem out there. It's hard to get someone who's registered as a contractor in very small communities just because of the economies of scale. If you want someone in a village who's a good carpenter, he's not able to, there's not enough work in the community for him to go get registered. So it was more or less, I guess, some sort of a, it doesn't, even though the standard hasn't changed, the intent here was to put out some sort of a recognition that there's a problem out there in these small communities, at least to sort of, it's more of sort of a, I guess, an expression of intent. Now, it's still a violation under existing law, but the exemption applies to the administrative and the civil penalty provisions that this bill is adding to the statutes.
I don't think I've ever seen that before. It's just interesting. So you're still breaking the law, but there isn't a penalty that's imposed.
Madam Chair, the civil penalty provisions would not apply in those communities. If you will, the criminal under existing statute would still apply. So I understand the question, and I don't have a sort of an answer to the equal protection sorts of things, but that's, I guess, in drafting the bill, sort of was our effort to try to, in working, you know, with the sponsor and talk, just sort of being sensitive to those sorts of issues that have sort of historically come up in these kinds of policy discussions.
I understand. Okay. Further questions from the committee? Representative Cott?
Well, ma'am, I had the opportunity to hear this in an earlier committee, so.
Been there, done that, huh?
Been there, done that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your testimony. I understand Fairbanks is back online. Our apologies to you, Mr. Dillard. Are you there now?
Yeah, can you hear me a little better this time?
We can.
Oh, very good. I want to thanks again for letting me testify today on this House Bill 81. What you've been told me so far really goes in line with what we're trying to do with the Alaska Homeless Association. We're really looking for ways to protect the consumer themselves. Because as contractors, we got insurances or workman's comp or liabilities or bonding requirements. We've got to take residential endorsement classes every 2 years, you know, to get certified. And there's ventilation requirements by Alaska Housing also we've got to do classes for. The problem we've seen through our home building association, we've got a growing concern of persons out there acting as contractors without the licensing and insurance and bonding requirements that we have. And like I said, with the residential endorsements we have to carry, we realize there is a great need for the handyman. There's people out there with lower income that got little windows that they need replaced, or the older folks, you know, on fixed incomes. But we want to make sure we stay within that handyman category. And if the job does go over $2,500 or so, we want to make sure that they're qualified to work on, you know, the homes and what we're doing up
better.
Here. We build in the harshest environment, you know, in the world. We're trying to heat houses when it's 40 below, when we've got one little piece of glass that's just an inch thick. I mean, there's a lot of things we've got to learn and keep up on to be able to build in these climates. And the other part of the equation we're really concerned about is the people, you know, they say they want to build their own houses, and they can do that, you know, every year, and I think we need to be able to do that. That's an Alaska thing, is you should be able to build your own house. But we've had people, a lot of people in the past, and it's going to be a growing concern in the future, to where they're just going to start a house and say it's for themselves, but all of a sudden they're going to sell it within that 1 year period. So if we can keep with a 2 year period, that will help with that. But we want to be able to, first off, protect the injured. Any person that's working on the job, that's why we carry workman's comp, is to protect the employees. And then again, with the homeowners, if they're going to sell a house that's not been not been qualified and looked at by the individuals that's working on it, then we've got a liability insurance that helps protect the homeowner of what we put into the house. And with the bonding requirements that we got, they've got a way to go back after the contractor. But if they're not going to be licensed in the first place and not really know what they were doing, there's no way for the homeowner to go back after and get, you know, their things adjusted and fixed. And this is a growing concern we've had through our association, and we're just trying to figure out a way to help the consumer and help our building industry to build the homes that we need to build for the people of today. So that's really all I've got to comment about today, but I sure thank you for listening.
So, in short, the reason behind the bill is that there are these individuals in the community that are out there representing themselves as qualified to build homes or work on major projects within homes. They're doing it without the expertise, without the real knowledge, and in the end you have consumers who have no recourse.
Exactly.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, in this case, a contractor would be bonded and licensed and go through all the requirements for certification. So that's what we want those folks who are already bonded to be on an equal playing field with those who obviously hold themselves up to be Secondarily, there's a safety issue if you're constructing homes or buildings or working on those and hold yourself out as a contractor, not licensed and haven't been reviewed. The home builders and other associations related to and affecting construction, I think, are in fear that it not only devaluates what a contractor license is and costs and is made up of, but it also creates unsafe homes and buildings. And to that end, another problem that I heard in testimony in Labor and Commerce Committee 2 weeks ago was that, as did Representative Cott, was that there were several instances where you had a, in this case, a gentleman with his sons, and they were all building a home. They were, a home-building family. And so they would try to get by that using loopholes or not registering. And in addition to that, that's why we added on page 5 in the last meeting in Labor and Commerce, page 5, you'll see lines 7 through 11. We're requiring that for at least 2 years you live in the home so that you're not building and claiming, well, it's my home and I'm going to build one every 6 months and it really isn't your home, or you're residing in it for a day. But in this case, in this family example, and hypothetically in the future, that's how someone might be able to get under the radar and say, okay, it is our home, and I'll sleep in it for a night, and then I'll build my next home. And so we're trying to be reasonable, and that's why we construed it to this level, to say, hey, you have to be in the home. You can read it for yourselves. But and if you're constructing a new one, let's say you had the example in Labor and Commerce was you had twins, and it's like, well, we're abiding by your two-year residence requirement, but we want to now we have five kids in the house, so we want to construct, and we are constructing a larger one, then you're exempted and you can move on with this waiver. But it stops the folks under the radar that are trying to do these projects not certified and not licensed or bonded.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Dillon? Representative Caulfield?
Well, my question maybe could be a general question, but he might have an answer to it, and that is, if we put the hard number of $2,500 in the statute, as outlined on the second page, having actually done some handyman work, where I've handled windows that valued nearly that, and yet I just installed a window. Might I not get paid for that under this rule?
Through the chair, Representative Cockhill, what on page 2 you noted?
I'm sorry, 2500? I might have missed the. No, I'm sorry. It's on page 4, section 8, where you have a combination of materials and labor of less than $5,000, and then you have a $2,500 limit on line 23 for a work price at $2,500 or more. So I'm just asking the question because sure. I've actually done some handyman work, and I've never put myself out as a contractor. And I just wondered how the number came to be, especially since I know the price of plywood, for example, has doubled over twice, I think, in the last 4 years.
Representative Cott, this is original law. It's already in the statute, so that part of the bill is just reflecting existing statute. But wasn't this your bill, Representative Cott, originally?
Very similar to this.
Yeah. When did you guys pass this?
Last year.
You were asleep.
Oh, my goodness.
But through the chair, that was to make sure that folks were licensed even on the smaller projects. But in this case, it has to do with a contractor, and so you wouldn't fit in this category anyway because you're not a licensed contractor, so you could do those projects and legally be under that radar, and not it wouldn't be necessary to get the licensing that a contractor, a specialty contractor, would have to get. But like the chair stated, our change is only in subsection 12.
I recognize that. Yeah. But you're also now ratcheting up the penalty, and the teeth now could bite me.
I don't. If just I, on the record, I don't.
So I wanted to know if I was going to fall into this category.
So Representative Anderson, you're saying then under the existing exemptions, then that Representative Coghill's work on construction, alteration, or repair of, I guess if it's your personal property, if it's an exemption. But I guess if you're doing it for somebody else. Representative Anderson?
Well, and I'm just reading, Madam Chair, that as I recall, we changed the law last year, the $5,000 or less. And
reduced from $10,000 to $5,000, Madam Chair.
That's right.
Well, but and it's if you notice, it states page 420, line 22. It states a contractor, it states. I think that's the reference, and I don't think you would be registered as a contractor, Representative Coghill, for a $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 project anyway. So that's why I don't think this would apply to you. The way I read it,
Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know I'm kind of pushing the point, but I don't want to inadvertently stand before somebody and say, I knew, but I didn't care, it governs contractors. I understand that on page 3, line 27, to the extent that this covered. But then it does not apply to, and then it goes down here, work on a project on one or more contractors. And that may be maybe lightly construed as just a personal agreement. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder about that, because I don't want to be the guy that says to my good neighbor, I'll put 5 windows in your house where the aggregate cost of those windows is $15,000, and I have to give up my labor.
It's an interesting point, because it does say the aggregate contract price of which labor and materials. So it could be that the materials themselves. But this was, I remember this bill going through. I remember there was discussion about Representative Cott.
I think Representative Coghill actually spoke against the bill, as I recall.
Now you remember why.
This particular part was basically addressing handymen who are out there doing, you know, perhaps what you're doing or contemplating doing, putting in windows. That amounts to an amount more than $5,000.
Without insurance.
Without insurance, without the bonding, without the contracting, specialty contractor's license that the rest of us have to abide by.
And I understand that would be a real misrepresentation of somebody if they thought that that's what you were doing. However, if you had an oral agreement and you dropped the window and somebody got angry, and then decided to go against what the original verbal agreement was, I just wonder where that would end up. That's, I'm just asking, because I haven't dropped one of the windows yet.
You know, one thing you could think...
And I'm not a contractor. I have done those. And as somebody who's worked as a volunteer out of a church many, many years, I have done many times over this amount of work trying to help people put houses back together. And without the idea that I ever had to be a contractor, but I was actually just pounding nails and helping people put things together.
One thing, Representative Coghill, you could think about would be prior to it going in, you know, to final passage on the floor, would be an amendment that would go into that exception category that would talk about volunteer work. That's something to think about, you know, whether you're doing it for family or friends or church or...
And I've actually done it for money. But this is not my primary vocation, and I've just done it because I had to carve out a certain amount of time, and I said, hey, I'll do it for this, and it's worth it. But I haven't gone out soliciting work either. I haven't put my name on a card. I haven't pretended to be a contractor.
Once it's clear on the record.
Make that clear on the record, but I have actually done some of these things.
Okay, there's one more person only to testify, Kathy Baldwin Johnson. Oh, you're on House Bill 81 sheet. My apologies. Okay, so anybody else in the audience to testify on House Bill 81? Anybody else online? Okay, with that, public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us and discussion from committee members. Representative Cott.
Madam Chair, not so much toward the bill, but I think this bill, as it's currently written, is a good piece of legislation and is indicative of the job that the previous committee did on it since this has come to this committee. I do not see any amendments before us, so I want to compliment the chair of the previous committee, the gentleman to my right,
hey,
for sponsoring the bill and working out some of the details that we worked out in Labor and Commerce. We did spend some time on some of the language here, and I think we've got a pretty good bill.
Good. Okay.
In spite of my friend across from me, his concerns, get licensed, we're happy.
One thing we will do, I think, just as the bill makes its way through, is we could have Vanessa request an opinion just to be sure that there aren't any equal protection issues surrounding the violation part. I mean, because that's why it came to judiciary. So that you impose that $1,000 fine on somebody in the rail belt and not in Southeast or in a smaller community, we might as well get an opinion on it, and it can follow the bill, and if we need to make changes, then we can do so.
And Madam Chair, just thank you. And Representative Cockhill's concerns on the volunteer part, we can work with the association, and because construction season is coming fast, and everybody always says they want to move their bill out as quick and get it passed as quick as possible, but that's a fair reason for this, that we want to make sure this is enforced.
Your motion?
And Madam Chair, I think on your concern about the equal protection, I think when the department reviews it, they'll determine that it's probably going to be okay, because in the parts of the bill that we impose a fine, the operative word is may, so there may not be a fine. We're leaving a little bit of discretion there to the department. So even if you live in Anchorage, you may not get a fine on the rail belt.
Representative Anderson?
I'll move CS for House Bill 81, version I, with individual recommendations and attached, I believe, zero fiscal note.
Okay, any objection to that motion? Hearing none, House Bill 81 is moved, unamended, on the Judiciary Committee. Okay, that brings us to House Bill 99, and I'm told that Kathy Baldwin-Johnson has a conflict. So, you want to come forward and give your testimony first so you can... We'll do it a bit out of order, just to accommodate your schedule.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kathy Baldwin-Johnson. I'm a family physician in Wasilla. I work for Providence Matanuska Healthcare, and I'm the volunteer medical director for the Children's Place, which is a children's advocacy center in the Valley. My interest in methamphetamine and my concerns about methamphetamine have to do with the impact on children. As many of you may or may not know, our problems with methamphetamine labs is rapidly increasing here in Alaska, and unfortunately the Mat-Su area seems to be at the heart of that. I won't, because I have some very highly qualified people coming behind me, I won't spend a lot of time talking about the methamphetamine manufacturing process itself, but I do want to say that when people are manufacturing methamphetamine in their homes, there are many hazards and risks, both with the parent chemicals that are being used, the manufacturing process itself, as well as the final drug product, and it's very common that children are in these homes. We know that substance abuse either causes or exacerbates at least 7 to 10 cases of child abuse and neglect, and with methamphetamine in particular, there are significant issues for kids. That includes injuries because of the chemicals, the manufacturing process, the needles that parents are using to inject themselves, the diversion of resources because parents are spending all of their time, energy, and money on methamphetamine and the manufacture of methamphetamine rather than buying food and clothing and taking care of their children. There are problems with attachment to their children if the parents, again, are spending all of their time indulging in substance abuse. There are all these environmental dangers that these folks will touch on that come after me, and certainly then exposure of kids to this criminal behavior and to a lot of strange people that are coming in and out of the home to buy the methamphetamine. There's also an association of methamphetamine use with escalating levels of violence, including pornography and sexual aggression, which again is not a healthy environment for kids. Some of the specific risks to children include organ damage. And there are certainly studies in other states that have shown that these kids end up suffering damage to their kidneys, their livers, their spleen, and that there's evidence for brain injury as well, including some permanent aggressive kinds of behaviors in these kids that would have been preventable had they not been in this. Another big issue is the ability of parents to continue to parent their children because the meth users themselves end up with brain damage, both their fine and gross motor functioning as well as their cognitive ability. And they end up losing their ability to be good parents to their children, which means then these children have to be found new homes. When parents are using this during pregnancy, there's significant risk to the unborn child, including death, birth defects, and when these kids have been followed out into their school years, these kids have suffered irreversible brain injuries as a result of their parents, of their mom using methamphetamine while they were pregnant. And you can add, those are measurable effects seen once they hit grade school. Kids in our state are using methamphetamine. The 2003 Youth Risk Behavior Survey showed that 6% of Alaskan high school students admitted that they had used methamphetamine at least once. And this is certainly at high school time is a time when adolescent brains are undergoing a lot of change and growth, so it's a really vulnerable time for these kids to get hooked on meth as well. Nationally, somewhere between 30% and 50% of these home meth labs have children living in them, and in Mat-Su, the unofficial count from our drug team there is that it's significantly higher, probably more like the close approaching 75%. A really frightening thing is that, again, studies done in the lower 48 show that 80% of children taken out of an active meth lab will test positive for methamphetamine if you do a urine drug screen on them within 2 hours. So that means these children, it's not that two-year-olds are using methamphetamine, it's just that it's in their environment. It's on the floors where they crawl, it's on the food that they eat, it's in the refrigerator right next to the Pepsi bottles, it's in the air that they breathe. These children are also at risk, in addition from the drugs themselves. Fires and explosions are really common in these meth labs because the manufacturing process can be really dangerous, which puts kids at risk from this. And certainly they are often neglected and abused by their parents and by the various people that are coming in and out of these homes. Children are more vulnerable to all these environmental risks. They're smaller, but they have a greater skin surface area compared to their body weight. They breathe more air, they eat more food, they drink more water, all those things in proportion to adults. So they get this into their systems. Their organ systems are immature and still developing, and that makes them especially vulnerable then to organ injury as a result of exposure to the drug and all these parent chemicals. So I'm absolutely in. Alaska does have lenient drug laws concerning methamphetamine and children in those homes compared to other Western states. And so we've actually had this looked at. There's a national organization that looks at model state drug laws, and so they've actually compared Alaska drug laws to other states. And I'm certainly absolutely in favor of anything that helps to keep our kids safer from what I think is going to be an increasing problem in our state.
Representative Cocker.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for your work. Your presentation yesterday at noon was excellent. Excellent in that it made his point. Horrible in what we actually had to look at. And then thank you for your work in the Children's Advocacy Centers. I appreciate that. In this law that we're looking at here, is this far different than what you might expect from comparing other state laws to our rather generous law, as you say? Are there other recommendations that you would see that should be made here?
Well, I think what I would really like to see are significantly stiffer penalties for people that are manufacturing methamphetamine with children in the home. And I would like to see manufacturing methamphetamine with children present classified as definitely as a type of child abuse, it escalate to a higher level of child endangerment. Then I think if I read this right, this it makes it a Class C felony, if I'm understanding this law correctly.
We are going up to second-degree manslaughter.
Second-degree manslaughter, or there was another provision there. But this is not with necessarily children just dying. I think we need something for children that are actually in these homes because they are certainly suffering as a result.
Sure. I'll probably take that to heart when I am working on a bill that may be able to take some of those thoughts to it. But in this particular case, I just wanted to know if there's anything in here that she was thinking it fell short on or should be added to.
Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony and
your
work.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, and I'm also told that Sergeant Ed Bryant has a time-sensitive day.
Actually, it's Detective Ed Bryant.
From me.
Sergeant.
He got promoted in an email that was sent to me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure, my supervisor would be pleased to hear that as well. Thank you for allowing me to come testify. I am with the Anchorage Police Department. I've been assigned to the drug unit for about 9 years now. So I have seen the rise of methamphetamine production in the state. I would echo the other speaker's comments regarding the damage to children. The bill as it's proposed now is certainly needed for the protection of the children as well as protection of the public in general. Case in point was January 19th of this year, we took down a methamphetamine lab in Anchorage in a multi-unit apartment building. Even being outside the building, there was evidence of the methamphetamine production because the acid gases that were produced in the lab came out of the vent and actually discolored and damaged the exterior of the home. The inside of the home was a light yellow color. All of the walls were light yellow color, except in the very corners where the iodine and other chemical fumes wouldn't settle because of the dead airspace in the very corners. Inside this home was an 18-month-old child. The state of Alaska right now has a statute, 1171-010, which is an unclassified felony. To deliver, if you're over 19 and you deliver a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 controlled substance to a person who's 3 years or more younger than you, that's an unclassified felony. Here we're talking about someone who doesn't have the option, the unwitting and the unwilling, namely children inside these labs. I guess my question would be, why would we make a penalty for manufacturing or attempt to manufacture methamphetamine in a residence where there are children? Why would we make that any less? Less of a problem, less for them. There's a lot of research, including the research done by the National Jewish Center in Colorado, for those of you that are familiar with that study, where methamphetamine cooks or productions were carried on in very controlled circumstances in residences, as well as sampling was done in controlled substances in 16 different locations to find out residual amounts of both controlled substances as well as the toxic substances that are used in methamphetamine production to find out if there is a problem with them and if so, what level they were. And the methodology is very complete. It's been proven. As the doctor stated, the methamphetamine is found everywhere in the house. Typically, in a meth lab, the other toxic chemicals, the acids, the very strong bases, such as sodium hydroxide, the organic solvents, the fuels, if you will, some of them are very, very volatile. Those are generally found right in the area of wherever the cook is or the process has taken place. But methamphetamine and some of these other chemicals, such as the iodine residue, is found throughout the house. As the doctor stated, that these children are being exposed to methamphetamine. One of methamphetamine's effects, if you will, that the reason why people like to use it, and that, which I think is a very important point we don't talk about enough, is why people actually do something so bad. It's because it makes people feel really, really good. And the process that happens is it causes the two of the very important brain chemicals we have, dopamine and serotonin, it causes those transmitters to fire all at once, which causes an extreme amount of euphoria. Unfortunately, at the same time, it damages and or destroys both the transmitting sites and the receptors in the brain. That's the brain damage, in addition to the cognitive abilities that the doctor spoke of. That's the brain damage that we speak of. Those two chemicals are related to our everyday pleasure levels. They are our mood regulators. They are essentially what keep us within the bounds of societal norms, of non-aggressive behavior, of being able to cope with different problems,
of being able to solve problems, of being able to cope with day-to-day living. And the people who use this or are subjected to it in the case of these children, they have no choice in this. They're going to suffer this brain damage regardless. They just have no choice. I am very passionate on this subject because I have seen the effects of this. Over the last 9 years in the drug unit, it's just grown like crazy. And I thank you very much for I don't know who proposed this bill, and I understand that Representative Coghill has some other work in progress. So we're very much in support of this bill and available for any kind of questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Detective. And it's the governor that proposed the bill, so just so you know. Representative Gruenberg. And Representative Gruenberg has joined us some time ago, for the record.
Oh, thank you. I have two questions, Detective. One of them I think I'm going to ask you, but it may be that I should be asking somebody else this question. And I would sort of ask if you or anybody else is better equipped to answer this question, if they would speak up. And Madam Chair, if you give me a little leeway. It really is kind of a chemist. And do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
I do not, sir.
Okay. Well, what it does in Section 5 is it states that except as authorized in AS 17.30. Thank you. I'm looking at page 3, line 27, that a person commits a crime of misconduct in the second degree, misconduct involving a controlled substance, second degree, if the person possesses methamphetamine in an organic solution with intent to extract it from it, blah, blah, blah. Why is it limited to methamphetamine in an organic solution?
And through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, what this refers to, an organic solution is a carbon-based solution. And typically, the solution that they're referring to is what the street term is meth oil. It's a product of the reaction. It's the next to the last step before you actually get methamphetamine hydrochloride.
Let me tell you where I'm going with the question, if I may dialogue. Might there be methamphetamines not in an organic solution that people might intend to extract from it something else? I'm wondering if this is under-inclusive, if maybe it should be broadened to include methamphetamines that aren't inorganic. I know nothing about this.
No, sir. this is inclusive.
That's fine. Okay, second question. And I'm handing out, a case just for ease, the definitions from AS 11.81.900. Oh, if you have an extra one, let me give one to the officer here. Sorry. Okay, thanks. We don't know whether they're going backwards or forwards.
Missed you, Representative Gruenberg. We thought you weren't going to be here today.
You wouldn't believe what I was doing. We won't go to that. Okay. in section...
We may.
I'll tell you later off the record. I'll tell you on the bill for tomorrow.
We need to take an at ease, or should we do it?
No, you're right. We'll see the bill soon enough. Okay. Subsection 22. Dwelling means a building that is designed for use as a permanent or temporary home or place of lodging. I'm focusing on the fact that it could be used or just designed for use. And I'm looking here on the bill, top of page 3, line 3, with reckless disregard that the building is a dwelling for children. And what I'm wondering, technically, you could have, particularly since you're dealing with the definition of building over here, consisting of propelled vehicles, apartment houses and stuff like that. You could have somebody in a meth lab, apartment or a car or something, that could be utilized as a lodging. I mean, talking about people could be living in their cars at some point, or an apartment that's never actually had a child in it, but under this is simply designed for use as a lodging. And it would still meet the requirement, even though a child, in fact, had never been near the place, because it was designed to be used as an apartment. And I'm wondering if we should say that it's a current dwelling putting the word current or something like that in.
Well, I see your point, Representative Grunberg, but it does say that it is a dwelling.
Yeah,
so never mind the definition.
Well, I guess maybe we need an opinion from some lawyer on that, because I could see a court reading that. It is technically a dwelling under subsection 22 here, if it's merely designed to be used as a place of lodging. And I would want to be sure that it wasn't read that way.
I see your point. I mean, if you wanted to add currently a dwelling,
I will just reserve
clear.
Supplement to that.
I'm kind of giving a preview, and maybe when
Innie's going to come up next. So.
But you just happen to be the guy on the hot seat at the time. Don't worry. But Annie, if you can, at the appropriate time.
She's up next. So. Thank you, Detective. Further questions, Representative Anderson?
And thank you so much, Detective, for your advocacy and years of service with the force. And your comments lead me to a question supplemental somewhat to Representative Grunberg's, and that is, if you look on, and we can ask Annie as well, but I thought you said made some salient comments about the fact that you can be in a different apartment, and through the air system and HVAC system, you can still affect children, and you've seen this at times where someone might think, well, I'm in a different room, so it doesn't matter, but no, there's, I guess, of the chemicals in the air that flows. But my staff caught something and wrote a note earlier. On page 2 of the bill, the very definition we were just talking about, page 2, lines 22 to 26, at the end of that, 25 to 26, it states, apartment units, offices, rented rooms, each unit is considered a part of the same building. So, you know, I'm a hang 'em high guy on this, too. I'm with you 100%, totally pro. Sorry, maybe that's the wrong way to say it, but prosecute. But, and I won't name names, but I think of Anchorage where there's super big apartments. And so Joe Schmo is cooking up meth, whatever the phrase is, and there's a child in another unit, which under this definition is the same building. I mean, really far away. I mean, like, it could be a block if there's some super large, and I won't say names, but in Anchorage, apartment buildings. And then I look to see what endangering the welfare of a child is in the first degree, because that's what they would be charged with, and it's a Class C felony. I don't want to give much latitude, but in your opinion, again, maybe I'm helping you out with the testimony, but your thought is you like that idea, and I probably support you too, but you like that idea because it could flow through the whole ventilation system.
Well, through the chair, Vice Chair, it's not just the chemicals itself. This past summer, also in Anchorage, we had a sixplex that was involved with there was a methamphetamine lab in this sixplex, and during the process of extracting, and I'm not sure if the individual was extracting the red phosphorus from the Starker plates or was extracting the pseudoephedrine from coal pills, but at some point he was boiling off of organic solvents. An explosion resulted, which literally blew the sixplex off of its foundation. When the officers went inside to do the initial assessment, from the outside, they hadn't recognized it. They went in to do the initial assessment, and one of the detectives was standing in the living room and realizing he could see the ground outside because the walls were shifted off the foundation. So it's not just the toxins that are there, but the explosion and fire hazard. So while you may have a structure that would say be there are apartment complexes, apartment buildings in the south end of Anchorage and Midtown area, which are 75, 80, 100 unit apartment buildings, if you could have a sufficient fire and explosion to cause structural damage or cause a loss of life there. So it's not just the toxins. That's another reason for my support of the change in definition of building. It's not just the fact that you could find methamphetamine outside of that apartment, but certainly the other hazards that are associated with it.
And just through the chair, final, I agree with you, and so that gives, for the record, good testimony on why this is important that it be so expansive for the definition of building. And I see that it says offices, too, so that means it could be the BP building. But the point is there's a safety aspect, and if there's a kid up there, then that's the consequence if you're going to do something like that in any office building.
Yes, sir, you have to realize a lot of the smaller daycare centers are constructed, they're maintained in strip malls. So you have other other industrial applications in a building where it would not be uncommon for someone to try to conceal a clandestine lab. And we are speaking strictly of methamphetamine here because that's our biggest problem. But certainly in my experience, and I'm sure in the state trooper's experience also, there are other types of labs out there that we haven't even touched on. There are people who would try to manufacture other controlled substances which are just as dangerous, if not more so, than methamphetamine. And those processes are far more dangerous than these. So
it's a lot. I appreciate that thorough answer.
Thank you, Detective. What we'll do is we'll have Annie Carpinetti, she's ready, come up and testify next. And that way we can get some of these. And we've got about four more people to testify, but I figure if you come up, we can get through some of these legal questions. And the other thing, too, Vanessa tells me you had conversations so about the definition of the building. Dwelling. Then the other question is if you just go through an explanation on the record of the transferred intent in Section 3. That was another question that I had. So just some of the questions that are out there.
Okay. I was under the impression that there are other witnesses that were from out of town that were, might be
testifying. Well,
there are. I just wanted to make sure that was not the case.
Is there anybody else in the audience that has a time constraint? Okay.
Did you want me to just describe the bill
yeah.
briefly, too?
Okay.
It does three things, as you already heard. It provides specifically that it is manslaughter to manufacture or deliver an illegal drug in violation of our drug laws, and a person dies as a result of ingesting that drug. And it specifically provides, as is allowed under our statutes, AS 1181-600, that as to the death, there is no additional culpable mental state required as an element of the offense. The culpable mental state is the drug violation itself. And the reason is this, is that people who manufacture or deliver illegal drugs are taking a huge risk, and they know that it's a risk, and it's a risk that they disregard because of the profit that is apparently worth it to them. We're not breaking any new ground when we're suggesting the statute. Many other states have similar laws. They do it in different ways. Some of them, it's decisional law based on felony murder statutes or laws. Other states have specific statutes, like is suggested here, dealing with the death as a result of a delivery or manufacture. I think that you've already heard evidence about the child endangerment provision. Currently, our law provides that it's a contributing to the delinquency of a minor under AS 1151-130, which is a Class A misdemeanor, to allow a child under 18 to be present during illegal drug activities. This would raise it to a Class C felony for manufacture or attempted manufacture. And finally, the meth in solution came from drug people, our drug enforcement people in Fairbanks. And you've probably heard enough about that, and I could just answer specific questions. You know, people carry around, they possess the meth in solution, and the only reason they do it is so that they can periodically extract from it powdered meth, and you've got people who know more about it than I do here, to then distribute. So it's right now, just possession of meth itself is a Class C felony. Manufacture of meth is an A felony. Possession of a precursor of meth with intent to manufacture meth is also a Class A felony. And the feeling is that possessing methamphetamine in this solution with intent to extract from it over a various number of times is serious and should be considered a Class A felony. So in terms of definitions, we work really hard on these definitions. And so I'll try and answer why we did. I think, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe that the fact that as to the circumstance of a child using the building as a dwelling, it says with reckless disregard that the building is a dwelling for one or more children under 18. I think that would take care of your concern that it maybe have been designed for a dwelling, but none actually lives there. But, you know, maybe we could consider saying currently used as a dwelling.
To the chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, I totally agree with this bill. and this section. I want to be certain, though, that it's not used in a more broad sense, because you could say, well, this is an old abandoned apartment house and has been in the past. A kid could get in here, but they're not in here now. We have such places in Mountain View.
Vanessa just suggested a fix that makes sense. In the definition section that Representative Grunberg handed out under dwelling, the second half of that definition, so after or, says is used as a person's permanent or temporary home or place of lodging. What you could do is just simply say in the bill, page 3, line 3, with reckless disregard that the building is used as a person's permanent or temporary home or place of lodging, and you could just make it explicit.
Yeah, either way, I'd offer that amendment, and it could be either way, whatever the bill drafters and the folks do. I'll offer that. Can we offer that as a conceptual amendment?
Yeah, let's just finish testimony, and then we'll do that. Okay.
In terms of the, did you have a question about the definition of building?
Representative Anderson just simply brought up, and I don't know that there's disagreement, but perhaps you could just on the record speak to the definition on page 2, subsection 2 of building, and just how you arrived at it.
Okay. Building is defined in our statutes for the whole of Title 11, but it that definition excludes units in an apartment building, and we clearly wanted to include them, so we repeated the definition from Title, from 1181, the general definition, but just changed the last sentence saying it does include other units in a building.
Anything further, Mr. Fernandez? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my question comes from a little ignorance here. I'm looking on page 3. Up above, I'm focusing on the underlying language. I'm kind of contrasted with the language on line 10, with intent to manufacture or deliver. Line 19, with intent to manufacture. And then here on line 28, with intent to extract from it. Might somebody, and again, Ms. Carpenetti, I'm not limiting this to you, but anybody in the audience who may want to answer, be qualified, might want to manufacture something from it, but it wouldn't technically be an intent to extract.
Through the chair, the reason we use the word extract is because methamphetamine in an organic solution is methamphetamine. So we couldn't call it a precursor because it's not a precursor. And the chemists at our lab in Anchorage were very opposed to calling it, you know, just defining it as a precursor because it isn't. It's methamphetamine. So you're taking methamphetamine in a particular form and you're extracting it with the use of, I think, hydrochloric acid.
It's hydrogen chloride gas.
Yes.
May I follow up?
Representative Grunberg.
And I gather from what you're saying, these people carry this stuff around with them?
Or they possess it in their home or whatever. Okay. It's like possessing a precursor, but it's not a precursor. It's just methamphetamine in a form that you pull it out as you would.
How do you know, and maybe I should be asking this to somebody, the detective or somebody, how do you know that the defendant intends to extract? How can you tell that?
That's, through the chair, that's very difficult. It's always hard to prove specific intent crimes. You look at all the circumstances, all the evidence you have, whether they've done it in the past, what...
My question, if I may, are any of these, without trying to make a law that's too broad, is there anything that can or should be done to say that certain types of evidence shall be prima facie evidence of intent?
Through the chair, that's tough because, you know, we do have a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every element of an offense, and we try and be cautious about doing.
Oh, I see. Okay.
There are some things that we sometimes say is prima facie evidence, but not necessarily an element of the offense because that takes it away from the jury or the judge to decide. Although sometimes it would be very tempting to do that.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Carpenetti. Okay, I have, Representative Cobb.
Yeah. Annie, just so I have this clear in my mind, Tom sells me on these illicit drugs, controlled substances. I turn around and sell it to Max. Max is the one that ends up dead. I'm the one that's going to be charged, not Tom. Is that correct?
Yes, I think you would. If Tom sells it to you and you sell it to
Max.
Excuse me for using your first name.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I believe
both could be.
I think you both could be.
And you wouldn't have a quorum.
I think you both could be.
I mean, how long down the drug chain can we establish that nexus?
It's always a matter of proof, and we don't have that many that we think we could prove, but if you distribute it to somebody else and we could prove that you did it, we could prosecute you under this statute.
Madam Chair, what is the current state of law? Say if Tom sells me that same drug and, I don't end up dead, but as a consequence of utilization, taking the drug, I go out there and kill someone else. What's out there right now that would maybe could be used as an aggravator if Tom is eventually picked up as a seller? I'm the user, but it was my action that...
Well, that's an interesting
something.
Question because that, although the Whiteside's case, Whiteside versus State, is what got us thinking about this in the first place, which a person sold heroin to a small amount of heroin to a buyer in Ketchikan. He ended up overdosing and dying as a result of ingesting the heroin, and the trial court found that the aggravating factor of somebody ending up being physically harmed as a result of the crime should apply and that the presumptive sentence should be increased. But the Court of Appeals disagreed because of the causation argument, because the person who took it made that choice himself to take the drugs. So by drafting this statute, we're trying to avoid that causation argument by saying the drugs themselves caused the death that you provided to your cohort on your left. But I don't think there's, and maybe the answer is, I don't think there's something that we have at this point.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
That's the question you were wondering.
Oftentimes, I guess, I'm not asking.
So that's why we were looking at this in the first place, that the court interpreted the causation requirement against our position.
Like felony murder, where you're...
Well, there's felony murder for drug offenses, but that's the sale of drug. If somebody gets killed in a drug sale, we can charge felony murder in the second degree for that. But this is different because it's the ingestion rather than, the very dangerous situation of a drug sale and guns are around and people get killed.
Yeah, it just meant the intent part that you can't engaging in that reckless activity that you're focusing on. We have 25 minutes left. I'd like to get this bill out today. We have three more people to testify online, so...
One question.
Representative Groenberg.
Wait.
In wrap-up.
And Madam Chair, I have to leave at 10 till, and I'd love to vote on the bill, so that's 22 minutes. So if we could do it with the committee's indulgence for the next committee. We're stacked today.
In wrap-up.
Yeah. I want to go back to Representative Cott's example and give you a tough case and wondering... That's hypothetical, not hypodermic. Somebody sells somebody some marijuana, and then they, unbeknownst to the original grower, they turn and deliver it to somebody else who takes a large quantity and overdoses. Totally unbeknownst to the original grower or whatever. Now, does that make the original grower guilty of manslaughter?
The chair, I think if we could prove that, yes, I think that would, and that is the risk you take when you manufacture or grow illegal drugs. And that's the recklessness that's involved.
Then why wouldn't the same argument apply to people who manufacture alcohol?
Well, we're getting way off topic. I appreciate the line of questioning. Carry on the dialogue after the committee. We're going to move on. Next, I have Deputy Chief Audie Holloway, who's online with the Anchorage Police Department. If you're still there.
I am here.
Thank you for your patience. And the briefer all of you are, I think you've got support from the committee, the better your chances of getting the bill out today are. So.
Yes, I can be quite brief. I just wanted to give some numbers on what we have for people who die from drugs, drug overdose deaths, or they die from drug overdose, the drugs that are provided usually by somebody else. And on an average, we have about 9 a year where we can say that it is completely completely clear that that person died from a drug overdose. Now, there are several others die from drug overdoses, and those 9 include accidental and intentional, whether you do it yourself and intend to do it or whether you do it accidentally. There are several others that don't get added into this because of the way we collect the figures and because of the other attendant circumstances that may surround the death. The drug use may lead to liver failure, or the person may die in a hospital, which is very typically what happens, is that the emergency medical services is pretty good, so we get people to a hospital and they either live a little bit longer or they die later, and it's not, that information is not collected. What I'm getting around to say is that there's a lot of people in Alaska, and I know particularly in Anchorage, that do die because of drugs that are provided by other people because of the inexact science of the way that they provide the drug. They don't have any type of way to make sure that the drugs are safe, nor do they care if the drugs are safe. I can remember 2 or 3 instances when I ran the drug unit where we had heroin come into town that was extremely potent, and we had 2 or 3 people die from use of that. We had marijuana that was soaked in some kind of chemical that caused 2 young teenagers to end up in the hospital. We had a death just last year from a teenager that took some THB that was provided by an older person, and she died right within minutes of taking it, basically, and they didn't do anything to get her any help. So this kind of situation does exist out there, and at this point, a lot of times we can't do anything about it because of the fact that the person intentionally took it themselves.
Thank you very much, Deputy Chief Holloway, for your testimony. Next, I have James Steele, who's also online, and then Sergeant Britt. Britt. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is James Steele. I actually come to this issue or in contact with this issue from 2 perspectives. One is as the Children's Services Manager for the South Central Region of the Office of Children's Services, located in Wasilla. Secondly, as the Deputy Chief of Central Mat-Su Fire Department, also located in the Mat-Su Borough. And I will hold, I'm going to cut my comments very brief so that, because I'm really interested in moving this bill forward. But I think all the other participants have done a good job of basically talking about the risk and the hazards. The production methods, as you've heard, can be extremely dangerous, not only toxic fumes, corrosive chemicals, poisonous gases, the threat of fire and explosion. And I think it's critical to keep in mind that the folks that we come in contact with are not scientists in a controlled environment producing this. There's the probability of mishap is really high. In the Mat-Su area, 2 years ago, the Mat-Su drug team seized around 30 labs. Last year, the numbers had increased to more than 50 labs. the MATSU field office for Children's Services are now receiving approximately 40 calls, Protective Services reports monthly, that involve methamphetamine in some aspect. During last year, we had 10 situations in which we had to remove the children and take custody of them. Out of those 10, 8 of them involved active labs. So I think children are really at a much higher risk because of just their natural behaviors, their natural actions. Children explore, and especially infants, their surroundings by crawling, touching. They place things into their mouths, and as you've heard, it's basically the entire living environment that becomes contaminated. So they are really at serious risk of harm. So I think in order, I know the time's getting late, so in order to allow the next speaker, I'll just close with those remarks or any questions at all.
Thank you, Mr. Steele. And next, in final wrap up here, we have Sergeant Tim Britt. And thanks for your patience.
And the chair, actually, it's Sergeant Tim Burt, and I have been with the Alaska State Troopers in the drug unit for about 9 years now. Initially, starting off in the Fairbanks area, dealing with meth labs in Fairbanks. Currently, in Southeast region, working with drug investigations and meth labs in Southeast as well. Department of Public Safety supports House Bill 99 due to the nature of these meth labs. The inherent dangers, the lack of training of the chemists, the way that they store the chemicals, whether the intentional byproducts that they create or unintentional through their lack of training, experience, and handling chemicals, it creates a great danger not only to the persons that may be living in the apartments, but also persons that are passing by within the close proximity. Also, in reference to mobile labs, children that may be transported in a vehicle where there, in fact, is a mobile lab in the trunk of that car, creates an extreme hazard. If that vehicle were to be involved in an accident or slide off the road, those chemicals, basically a chemical cocktail that just got shooken up and mixed up with other things, again, creates an extreme hazard. I guess I'd like to wrap up in view of the time crunch. In my experience and experience of most of the other state troopers I'm familiar with that have investigated these meth labs, meth cooks have little regard for their own health and safety, and they have little regard for the health and safety of others, whether it be persons they know or persons they don't know, whether they be children, adults, or law enforcement. So, and I'm available for any questions if there are any.
Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Okay, anybody else I've overlooked in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill 99? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed. That brings House Bill 99 back before us. There is an amendment offered as Representative Gruenberg and myself to page 3, line 3. This will be amendment number 1. I'll move the amendment. Is there an objection to amendment number 1? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. Is there any further discussion or amendments on House Bill 99? Representative Cobb.
I'm not sure where I'm going with this, and I'll probably have a little time to think about it between this committee's actions and when we have it before us again, but I'm still a little puzzled on the scenario I gave Annie. I'm not sure if there's a fix for it, but it just seems to me that if somebody sells me controlled substance and I don't die as a consequence of ingesting that controlled substance, but I'm blown out of my mind, you know, just can't reason right from wrong, and I do something that causes another person's death, I think we should be able to go back to the original seller and establish the nexus between my actions that caused someone's death and the seller who sold me the controlled substance. But like I said, I'm not prepared to offer any amendment at this point. I just want to see if we can't reach a little deeper if there's not a mechanism already out there that won't allow for this. I don't know what my defense would be in court, plead insanity, and whatever the case might be, and then get nobody. That doesn't help the ultimate victim in the case. But having said that, Madam Chair, I'm ready to make the motion if you're ready. Or
Representative Gruenberg?
I talked with Ms. Carpinetti, and I'm going to paraphrase what she said to me. I am informed that if somebody, and I'm looking on page 1, line 11, simply knowingly possesses the controlled substance, marijuana or whatever, that wouldn't be enough to trigger the manslaughter charge. My scenario was, suppose somebody possessed some marijuana or something like that, and somebody broke it and stole it, and then overdosed. Whether that person that had grown it and had it stolen from her or him would be guilty of manslaughter, and I was told no. That partially, and I believe me, I'm not soft on crime or these people, but that being said, I'm anxious that before we convict somebody of manslaughter that they have some legal and moral culpability. And I am somewhat troubled, and my analogy to the legitimate wine, beer, and liquor manufacturers, who are my friends, by the way, are not, you know, thrown logically down the same road as these people. I am somewhat troubled by somebody whose only crime may have been selling something to person A, then it goes to person B, person C, and then distributed on the street way down the road with no knowledge. Now, you can say this was in fact negligent in the manufacture and distribution. And I am persuaded by that, but I am somewhat troubled.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. Representative Cott.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Yeah,
I am ready.
Conclusion, Representative Gruenberg, Madam Chair, I'd move that we move House Bill 99 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes to the Finance Committee.
As amended.
As amended.
Any objection to that motion? Hearing none, House Judiciary is adjourned early. That's pretty amazing.
Max, your point is taken.